Star Wars.
In the Vanaparvan, which belongs to the ancient Indian Mahabharata, chapters 168 to 173, the dwellings of the gods are described as space settlements, which orbited high above the earth. The same sort of thing can be found in chapter 3, verses 6 to 10 of the Sabaparva. These gigantic space stations had names such as Vaihyasu, Gaganakara, and Kekara. They were so enormous that the shuttle ships, the Vimanas, could fly right into them through mighty gates. We are not talking about obscure fragments which no one can examine, but ancient Indian traditional texts which are to be found in any large library. In the Dronaparva section of the Mahabharata, page 690, verse 62, we can read how three great and beautifully built cities revolve around the earth. From these, discord spreads to the people on earth, and also amongst the gods themselves in a war of galactic proportions. Verse 77. Shiva, who rode upon this most excellent chariot that was composed of all the forces of heaven, prepared himself for the destruction of the three heavenly towns. And Sthanu, this leader of the destroyers, this thwarter of the Asuras, this fine fighter of immeasurable bravery, drew up his forces in an excellent battle position. When the three towns next crossed each other's paths in the firmament, the god Mahadeva shot them through with a terrible stream of light from the threefold mouth of his weapon. The Danavas were unable to look up into the path of this streaming light, which was ensouled with yoga fire and contained the power of Vishnu and Soma. While the three settlements began to burn, Parvati hurried there to see the show. The gods of Hinduism battled with each other in the firmament, like Ishmael or Lucifer in Jewish tradition. Ishmael was the greatest prince of angels in heaven, and Ishmael went and united with all the highest armies of heaven against his Lord. He gathered his armies about him and descended with them, and began to seek companions upon the earth. And what do we read in Enoch? He described the mutiny among the angels and even listed their names. This core of tradition, the battle in heaven, the struggle between the gods, is the decisive thing, and is made a farce of by the naive concept of heaven to which the various religions subscribe. In Hinduism, human beings attain absolute serenity through their own powers, through continual cycles of rebirth during which they improve and cleanse their karma. But they are helped in this by the gods, and ultimately by the universal god, Brahma. But the Hindus are also familiar with the idea of the god's return. Vishnu will one day be reborn as Krishna and save the earth from the mess it has got itself into. Where the idea of karma or reincarnation fits into all this is a mystery for Westerners. How did the Hindus ever come to believe in a continuous cycle of rebirth in which they haul their good and bad deeds from one life to the next? The extraordinarily complex teachings of karma are described in the Jain religion in very precise detail. Jainism is, alongside Buddhism and Hinduism, one of the three major religions of India. Centuries before the arrival of Buddhism, Jainism arose in northern India, then gradually spread throughout the whole subcontinent. Its adherents say that it was originally founded in very ancient times, millennia ago. They believe its teachings are eternal and imperishable, even though they may be forgotten for long periods at a time. The Jain religion is encompassed in a whole series of pre-Buddhist texts, which are, there is no other way of putting it, quite extraordinary. Ancient science. The theological cum scientific literature of Jainism contains stories of holy men, songs about the primeval creators, as well as precepts of all kinds. These works are, in a similar way to the Bible, collected together under the umbrella of a single title, Shvetambaras. They are divided into 45 main sections, each with quite unpronounceable names. The Vyāhya Prajnaptyanga presents the whole teaching of Jainism in dialogues and legends. The Anuttara Upapatika Dashanga tells the stories of the primeval holy ones who rose into the highest heavenly worlds. In the Purvagata section are scientific books and descriptions. Within this, the Utpeda Purva deals with the formation and dissolution of all the different substances, chemistry. The Virya Pravada Purva describes the forces active in the substance of gods and great men. The Pranavada Purva examines the art of healing. The Loka Bindusara Purva deals with mathematics and redemption. As if all that was not enough, there are also 12 Upangas, which describe all aspects of the sun, moon, and other planetary bodies, as well as the life forms which inhabit them. In addition, the Opapatika tells us how divine existence can be attained. We are also provided with a list of divine kings, Prakirnas, Book 7. Apart from these writings, there are also supposed to have been books which existed in the deep primeval mists of time, but which have been lost. But the Jains believe that such writings were passed on orally from priest to priest down through the generations. They are not perturbed by their loss, since reincarnations of the ancient prophets continually reappear, who reveal their content anew, to the extent that the times and people are ready to receive such teachings. The content of the lost texts has only survived in fragments, but even these deal with the most astonishing things. How one can travel to far lands by magic means. How one can perform miracles. How one can transform plants and metals. How one can fly through the air. Flying through the air is also described in Sanskrit literature. My book, Der Götterschock, deals with this in detail. According to the Jain teaching, the epoch in which we live is only one of many. Before our time, there were other cosmic periods, and shortly, round about the year 2000, a new epoch is supposed to begin. Such new epochs are always heralded by 24 prophets, the Tirthankaras. The prophets of our time are just being born, or are perhaps already adults. The religious leaders of Jainism believe that they even know their names and other details of their lives. Impossible dates. The first of these Tirthankaras was Rishabha. He dwelt for a staggering 8,400,000 years upon the earth. Rishabha was of giant proportions. All the patriarchs who succeeded him gradually diminished in stature and longevity. However, the 21st of them, whose name was Arishtanami, still lived for 1,000 years and was 10 bow lengths tall. Only the last two, Parshva and Mahavira, lived to what we would consider a reasonable age. Parshva lived to 100 and was only 9 feet tall, while Mahavira, the 24th of the Tirthankaras, only made it to a mere 72 and was just 7 feet tall. The Jains place the appearance of their Tirthankaras in such ancient times that it makes one dizzy to think of it. The two last were supposed to have died in 750 and 500 BC, respectively, while the successor to Rishabha, the first patriarch, graced the earth for about 84,000 years. These numbers, which are just set down in front of us, should actually make our myth investigators, and our theologians as well, sit up and take notice. Why? Because we have here, well packaged in religious concepts, a kernel of folk memory that gleams through many holy and not so holy books. Let me, very briefly, in telegram style, refresh your memory. In the ancient Babylonian list of kings, WB 444, 10 kings are counted from the creation of the earth up to the flood. These ruled, give or take, a year or two for 456,000 years. After the flood, the kingdom descended once more from the heavens, and the 23 kings which followed ruled together for 24,500 years, 3 months and 3.5 days. To the biblical patriarchs are attributed just as unbelievable ages. Adam is supposed to have lived for more than 900 years. Enoch was 365 years old when he rose up into the clouds, and his son Methuselah carried on for 969 years. It was no different in ancient Egypt. The priest Manetho recorded that the first divine ruler in Egypt was Hephaistos, who also brought the gift of fire. Then followed Cronos, Osiris, Typhon, Horns, and the son of Isis. After the gods, the race of god descendants ruled for 1,255 years, and then other kings ruled for 1,817 years. After this, 30 more kings ruled for 1,790 years, then 10 others for 350 years. The kingdom of the spirits of the dead and the god descendants encompassed 5,813 years. Such impossible dates are confirmed by the historian Diodor of Sicily, who 2,000 years ago wrote a whole library of works consisting of 40 volumes. From Osiris and Isis until the rule of Alexander, who founded the city in Egypt, which is named after him, more than 10,000 years are said to have passed. Some say, though, that the period is actually only a little less than 23,000 years. And as my last witness testifying to such impossible dates, let me mention the Greek Hesiod in his Myth of the Five Races of Mankind. He wrote, about 700 B.C., that originally the immortal gods, Cronos and his companions, created human beings. Those heroes of excellent descent, called demigods, who in the time before ours dwelt upon the endless earth. Let us now return to the Jains, who, it has turned out in the meantime, are by no means alone in recording dates of staggering proportions. Many Jain accounts are, seen from the standpoint of modern science, quite revolutionary. Their concept of time, of Kala, seems like something formulated by Albert Einstein. Their smallest unit of time is the Samaya. This is the time it takes for the slowest atom to move the distance of its own length. Innumerable Samayas form one Avalika, and measurable at last, 1,677,216 of these Avalikas give us one Muhurta, which equates with 48 of our minutes. 30 Muhurtas give us one Aharatra, which is exactly one day and night. Do you get it yet? Multiply 48 minutes, one Muhurta, by 30, and you arrive at 1,440 of our minutes, which is exactly the same as the number of minutes in 24 hours. But the time reckoning of the Jains is thousands of years old, and was originally passed to humans by heavenly beings. 15 Aharatras give, conforming with our time measurement, one Paksha, which is half a month. Two pakshas are therefore, of course, one masa, or 1 month. 2 months make one season. 3 seasons make one ayana, or term. 2 ayanas give us 1 year, and 8,400,000 years make one purvanga. But it continues. 8,400,000 of these purvangas make one purva. 16,800,000 years. The Jains' counting carries on to 77 figure numbers. Beyond this, their time values are given in terms of specific concepts similar to our light years, for a distance of 9,500,000,000,000 kilometers. One might well be tempted to call this crazy idiosyncrasy, if it were not for the fact that the Mayas of Central America operate with similarly staggering numbers, and also relate them to time and the universe in the same way as the Jains in far-distant Asia. The Jains also took from their heavenly teachers definitions of space which are astonishing, and which in the end, or at last, render comprehensible its connection with the mysterious idea of karma. I can only give a brief resume here of this extremely complex and involved doctrine, an understanding of which I gleaned from a book by the theologian Helmut von Klassenapp. In the scientific writings of the Jains, the atom occupies a point in space. This atom can connect with others to form a skanda, which then encompasses several or an immeasurable number of spatial points. Our own science teaches the same. 2 atoms can form a chain of the smallest proportions, but there are also molecule chains consisting of many millions of atoms. These atom chains give rise to substance and materials of various densities. The Jain teaching distinguishes 6 chief forms of such chains or connections. Fine-fine, things that are invisible. Fine, things that are still invisible. Fine coarse, things that are invisible but perceptible by smell and hearing. Coarse fine, things one can see but not feel, such as shadow or darkness. Coarse, things which reunite by themselves, such as water or oil. Coarse, coarse, things which do not reunite without external help. Stone, metal. In Jainism, even a shadow or a reflection is considered material, because it is produced by a thing. Even sound is not categorized as fine, fine, but as fine materiality, which arises as a result of aggregates of atoms rubbing against one another. In this teaching, the fine, fine substance is able to permeate everything, and therefore have an altering influence on other substances. The substance which penetrates a soul expresses itself as karma, which brings us back to rebirth. Still with me? Karma remains eternal. It is common knowledge nowadays that every kind of matter, whether a table or a bit of bone, can be reduced to the atomic level. The atom itself consists of subatomic particles, one of which is the electron, which oscillates in an unimaginable rhythm of 10 to the power of 23 per second. The matter of this electron would be characterized by the Jains as fine, fine. It can no longer be grasped and, in addition, is immortal. Atoms can enter all possible chains and combinations, but the electron always accompanies them. It acts like the spirit within matter, similar to a magnetic field or radio wave which permeates particular substances. Now, the thoughts of every life form influence its deeds. The substance of the world is the substance of the spirit, wrote the English astronomer and physicist Arthur Eddington, 1882-1944. And the Nobel Prize winner Max Planck formulated it in these words: "There is no matter as such. All matter arises and is sustained only by virtue of a force which makes atomic particles oscillate. Our existence is the consequence of a previous act. We would not exist without a prior life which gave rise to us. And this will not change if, in the future, we learn how to create life artificially. In other words, every existence is a link in the long chain of previous or future existences. Since our thoughts direct our actions, these actions in turn leave their traces upon our mind or spirit. One could, for example, describe a magnetic field as mind, but it is one which has an influence on matter. The Jains view what we call soul as the fine, fine materiality of the physical body. This materiality is as untouched by the body as the electron is by the atom nucleus. An electron does belong to the atom, but the two never come into actual contact. The atom can alter its position, join with others to form gigantic molecule chains, and will always be accompanied by electrons. But, strange to say, not the same electrons, for the electron leaps from one atom to another, for example, when heat is applied. And in the very billionth of a second in which an electron leaps to a new atom, the place vacated by it is filled by another electron. So we have an eternal, immortal, fine, fine activity, an oscillation beyond the material atom. The Jains see karma in the same way. It does not matter what happens to the body, whether it is burned or eaten by worms, for karma remains immortal. This karma contains all the information about the life form to which it belongs. During life we think and feel. This thinking and feeling is transposed onto the fine, fine substance of karma, similar to an engraving. When this karma is formed into a new body, it already contains all the information from its previous existence and continues to do so for all eternity. But since the ultimate aim of life is to attain a condition of absolute serenity by becoming one with Brahma, karma will lead us towards this goal through a series of countless reincarnations. This way of thinking is not so far removed from modern philosophy and the discoveries of modern physics. What may astonish us, though, is that such complex theories were taught millennia ago, and by teachers who appeared out of the depths of the universe. The last epoch of the Jains, which was followed by our own times, began around 600 BC, with the last of the 24 Tirthankaras. This Tirthankara was called Mahavira. And who was he? A king's son whose embryo was implanted in the womb of his mother, the young queen, by heavenly beings. All these heavenly teachers of ancient times are supposed to reappear, born into new bodies. The Jains have many old drawings which depict the 24th Tirthankara, the prophet Mahavira. Above the procession in his honor, portrayed in the engraving shown in the plate section, float five heavenly aircraft. There is a distinct difference between the Jains' expectations of the return of the gods and those of Christians, Muslims, or Jews. The latter believe that a Messiah and highest judge will appear, after which the faithful will enjoy heavenly glory, while the unfaithful roast in hell. The Jains do not expect a single savior, but several at once. The prophets or Tirthankaras continually return at every epoch. There is no final end of the world after their appearance, not heavenly joy and ambrosia, nor eternal damnation either, but simply a new act in the drama of the universe. The Tirthankaras are less saviors than helpers. They prepare human beings for the next stage and epoch. That is why they are born as human beings. Think of the Son of Man in the prophecies of Enoch. But their substance, their karmic knowledge, derives from the universe. Not earthly, but extraterrestrial forces plant the seed or the embryo into the womb. It is also worth remembering that these ideas were current centuries, if not millennia, before the birth of Christ, and that the Jains can therefore hardly have taken the Immaculate Conception from Christianity, rather the other way around. It is not surprising if such cosmic teachers as the Tirthankaras were well versed in astronomy and astrophysics. It is from such a source that the Jains derived their, to us incomprehensible, astronomical dates. Their teachings showed that they were able to measure the dimensions of the universe. Their unit of measurement was the Raju, the distance which God flies in 6 months when he travels at 2,057,152 yojanas a second. The Jain teachings say that the earth is surrounded by three layers, which are characterized according to their density: dense as water, dense as wind, and dense as a fine wind. Beyond these lie empty space. Our modern science has come to the same conclusion: atmosphere, troposphere, containing nitrogen and oxygen, and stratosphere, with the ozone layer. Beyond that is interplanetary space. People nowadays have increasingly come to hold the view that other life forms apart from us must exist in the universe. The Jains have always believed this. For them, the whole universe is filled with forms of life which are distributed unevenly across the heavens. It is interesting to note that, though they recognize the existence of plants and basic life forms on many different planets, it is only on a few specific planets that beings exist who are endowed with voluntary movement. The philosophers of the Jain religion describe the different characteristics which the inhabitants of various worlds possess. The heavens of the gods even have a name, Kalpas. There one can, apparently, find wonderful flying palaces, moving structures of which whole towns are often composed. These heavenly towns are ranged one above the other in such a way that from the center of each level, the Vimanas, divine chariots, can venture forth in all directions. When one epoch ends and new Tirthankaras are due to be born, a bell sounds in the chief palace of heaven. This bell causes bells to ring in all the other 3,199,999 heavenly palaces. Then the gods gather together, partly out of love for the Tirthankaras, partly out of curiosity. And then, born on a flying palace, they visit our solar system, and a new epoch begins upon the earth. Waiting for the Super Buddha. In Buddhism, the fundamental idea of redemption appears in a very similar form to Jainism. The Jains, however, were teaching before the arrival of Buddha, 560 to 480 BC. Buddha means the Awakened One or the Illumined One. Buddha's ordinary name was Siddhartha. He came from a noble family and grew up in the lap of luxury in the palace of his father in the foothills of the Nepalese Himalayas. At the age of 29, he had had enough of his rarefied existence. He left home, devoted himself for 7 years to the art and practice of meditation, and sought a path of knowledge. But the gods of folklore, legend, and mythology had already been around for a long time in Buddha's day. After his illumination, he felt himself to be the incarnation of a heavenly being. He began to preach to his disciples the fourfold path, which could lead all people to Buddhahood, to illumination. Buddha was convinced that the future would bring other Buddhas. In his farewell speech, the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, he speaks of these Buddhas of the future. He prophesied to his disciples that one of them would come at a time when India would be crammed full of people. The towns and villages would then be as densely populated as hen coops. In the whole of India, there would be 84,000 towns. In the town of Ketumati, the modern Benares, would live a king by the name of Sankara, who would rule the whole world, but without force, just through the power of his righteousness. And during the rule of this king, the sublime Maitreya, also called Maitreya, would descend to the earth, a phenomenal and wholly unique chariot driver and knower of worlds, a teacher of gods and men, in other words, the perfect Buddha. Buddha's prophecy of a super Buddha is similar to the Jain teaching of the return of the Tirthankaras. Buddhism also speaks of the different epochs which are compared with a turning wheel. The only difference is that in Buddhism, these epochs are immeasurably long. The idea of four, or in Jainism, six epochs, also informs Sumerian Babylonian mythology. In cultures which are far removed from each other, the same numbers are often found. A professor of religious history, Dr. Alfred Jeremias, became aware of such parallels 65 years ago. Here is just one example. According to Babylonian accounts, the ancient kings or rulers of heaven ruled for thousands of years. The dates applied to the gods, Anu, Enlil, Ea, Sin, and Samas, are remarkably close to the periods attributed to the Yugas or epochs in India. Anu equals 4,320. Kali Yuga equals 432,000. Enlil equals 3,600. Kali Yuga equals 360,000. Ea equals 2,880. Deva Yuga equals 288,000. Sin equals 2,160. Treta Yuga equals 216,000. Sama equals 440. Dvapara Yuga equals 144,000. Adad equals 432. Maha Yuga equals 4,320,000. There is a reason for the fact that Kali Yuga appears twice. The Kali Yuga without twilight is of shorter duration than the Kali Yuga with twilight. The number of zeros is not important, but the correspondence of the basic digits demonstrates a common original source. The number 4,320,000 of the Mahayuga, great epoch, is identical with that of the third pre-Diluvian king Enme Enlu Anna, who ruled for 12 sar, or 43,200 years. And the number 288,000 of the Deva Yuga corresponds to the period of rule of the sixth king, Ensib-Zi-Anna. He survived for 8 sar, or 28,800 years. In Greece can be found the oldest literary reference to a world epoch, in the writings of the poet Heraclitus. He quotes a period of 10,800,000 years, which corresponds precisely with the second period of the ancient kings of Sumeria, 30 sar, or 108,000 years. These numbers do not have any direct connection with the return of some savior or other, but they demonstrate the common ground that different traditions share. The only way to explain these correspondences is to assume that there must, at the dawn of time, have been a single original teaching. This common source must lie very far back in ancient times, for otherwise it would be mentioned in historical records. Psychological cover-ups. Psychology does not help me in the slightest in my researches into the idea of the god's return. I have ascertained that all cultures demonstrated this idea in some form, and that it is always connected with the stars and with saviors who come from beyond the earth. In addition, frequent mention is made of artificial fertilization of an embryo that is brought by the gods. I have no choice but to believe that these ideas have a common origin, and one which is inaccessible to psychology. Of course, it is understandable that people might long for a great savior, king, and super Buddha when times are bad enough. People wish for all sorts of cloud cuckoo lands. But this cannot explain the connections and correspondences between all the different traditions. Wishes alone cannot provide such precise accounts in the first person and all the details of dates and names. Or do people think that Enoch invented the long list of names and functions of the mutineer angels? Or that the idea of measuring the universe with the number 2,057,125 yajanas simply floated down into the head of some dreamer under a fig tree? Psychology is of no more help either in explaining the identical dates among different cultural traditions, or the widespread idea that artificial fertilizations and embryo implants took place. Quite another matter is the way that later religions transformed these concepts in order to glorify their saviors with an immaculate conception. That certainly is understandable from a psychological point of view. Even today, Catholic Christians still believe that Jesus was immaculately conceived by Mary. They have to believe it, for it is a dogma or article of faith of the Church. Though to be strictly fair, one should add that the opposite cannot be scientifically proved either. How can we actually know whether Jesus, or if you like, the Indian prophet Sai Baba, did not develop from a cosmic seed? That is, after all, what went on in ancient times. All great gods and god-kings had to have immaculate credentials so as to be thought equal to their predecessors. Seeds from Heaven. The seed which developed into the Akkadian king Hammurabi, 1726 to 1686 BC, was said to have been implanted in his mother by the sun god. Hammurabi later became the greatest lawgiver. From him derived the most ancient recorded rules and regulations for ordering human society, the Codex Hammurabi. The stone pillar over 2 meters high upon which these laws were engraved was dug up at the beginning of our century in Susa. Today it can be seen in the Paris Louvre. The Codex Hammurabi consists of 282 paragraphs. According to Hammurabi, these were given to him by the God of Heaven, in just the same way as Moses received the tablets of the commandments directly from the hand of God. In the foreword to his rule collection, Hammurabi expressly says that Bel, the Lord of heaven and earth, had chosen him to spread justice through the land, to destroy the wicked, and to prevent the strong suppressing the weak. And of course the people looked forward to the return of their lawgiver. All that we can, in retrospect, be sure of is that Hammurabi achieved something remarkable, and distinguished himself from all his contemporaries through various unusual deeds. Of course, it would be possible to assume that divine origin was attributed to him only after his death, if it were not for the stone pillar, which bears his own testimony, written during his life, that he had been chosen by the gods. Should we call the supreme lawgiver a supreme liar? That would be like accusing Moses of making up the story of receiving the stone tablets on the holy mountain. We, clever and superior modern people, know, of course, that the seed of King Hammurabi could not possibly have come from the sun god. But how do we know it? We were not there, and the skeleton of Hammurabi has never been subjected to genetic research. It is fairly typical of human logic that we reject Hammurabi's claim to having contact with otherworldly beings, while accepting the stories of Moses and other prophets. The Assyrian king Assurbanipal, 668-622 BC, in whose clay tablet library the Epic of Gilgamesh was discovered, was also immaculately conceived. He was the son of the goddess Ishtar, who suckled him as a baby. Ishtar must have come from other worlds because it says in a cuneiform text, "Her four breasts lay upon your mouth, you suckled upon two, in two you hid your face." That's right, four breasts. Enough to make some of us envious. This king Assurbanipal received the authority for his decisions from the divine advice of the gods Bel, Marduk, and Nabu. The last was the omniscient god from whom humanity learned to write in script. In the Louvre, there is a cylindrical relief sculpture upon which Nabu is depicted next to Marduk. Nabu's chief temple was situated in Borsippa, and it bore the name Temple of the Seven Command Transmitters of the Heaven and the Earth. Strange name. Was all this just self-aggrandizement on the part of the ruling elite? Did their authority come to depend on the people and priests believing that they were of divine origin? Personally, I do not think so. Not every king and founder of religions laid claim to bearing a heavenly seed within him. Only some from those undateable mists of time were convinced that they had a quite specific genetic code to pass on. We must not forget that similar stories appear in many different traditions and in various undateable texts, the Egyptians, Enoch, the Jains, and of course the Apocrypha of the Old Testament. The last also speaks of divine teachers, even if they are called fallen angels, and there as well, in the hidden mists of Jewish tradition, we find an abundance of characters whose seed was not of earthly origin. Of course, these things do not find a very receptive audience. People hold them at arm's length. And suddenly, Erich von Däniken is said to be in cahoots with a bunch of idiotic racists, as if it was I who had invented the idea of heavenly seed and chosen ones. I cannot be held responsible for such concepts. They come straight out of ancient traditions and texts which are holy for many peoples. So Noah, the survivor of the flood, for example, was not just anyone. His earthly father is named as Lamech. But in fact, Lamech was not his physical father. Everyone can read this for himself in the Dead Sea Scrolls. It says there that one day Lamech returned home from a journey which had taken more than 9 months. Once home, he found a baby who did not belong to his family. It had different eyes, different hair color, and a different kind of skin. Furious, Lamech went to his wife, who swore by all that was holy that she had not slept with a stranger, let alone a soldier or a son of heaven. Worried, Lamech went off to ask his father's advice. This was no other than Methuselah. He had no light to shed on the matter, and so, in his turn, went off to ask his father, Lamech's grandfather. And who was that? Our friend Enoch. He said to his son Methuselah that Lamech should accept the boy as his own son and not be angry with his wife, for the guardians of the sky had placed the seed in his wife's womb. They had done this so that the cuckoo's egg, as it were, should grow into the progenitor of a new race after the flood. This episode shows that Enoch, who later traveled up to the clouds in a fiery chariot, was already informed about the approaching catastrophic deluge. Who had told him? The guardians of the sky. And who arranged the artificial fertilization of Lamech's wife? The same space travelers. It is with such examples that I try to illuminate accounts and traditions that are to be found the whole world over, and that have existed for many thousands of years. This divine jet set, these innumerable sons of gods, come leaping out at one from almost every mythology in the world.